Carmel, California, and it's Friday, May 25th, 1979, the end of that month again. I still go faster than ever. This is tape number 390, and it's side one. Most of this tape I'll be dealing with the Dan White trial in San Francisco, the verdict of the jury, and the consequences of that trial. But there are a few things I just want to get into for a moment before I do that. One of the subscribers to these tapes sent me an article from the Philadelphia Inquirer. The date is May the 20th, 1979. Space Awaiting Colonists. And it tells about the psychological problems they'll have with children when we get to these space colonies, and that 200 industrialists and diplomats and physicists and social scientists met at Princeton University on the subject of constructing these space stations within the next 15 years. And of course, you know, I've done the tapes on Alternative 3, the book that says they're already built and that people are being shipped up there to these space stations for the purposes of genocide, for eliminating 93% of the population on planet Earth. This article, as I say, is about whole families who will live in space, and the problem that the anthropologists will have, the psychic effect of living away from Earth. I will go back to that subject maybe next week or the week after, Alternative 3, but any articles you have, copy them and send them to me. And I think once your consciousness is aware that this project is taking place, and if you can entertain the possibility that it is being used not to protect us but for genocide, perhaps some combined effort against the space agencies could be made. I don't know if it can be stopped, but there are people that are catching on to these colonies, and I do appreciate getting articles such as this. I'm glad to see that you're picking them up in your newspapers. This was a hard week in terms of elections, international elections. It was just about 2 weeks ago that Margaret Thatcher was elected in Great Britain as a prime minister. It came right on top of the scandals that an $83 million espionage clandestine fund from South Africa was sending money to Great Britain for her election. The man who blew the whistle on that has disappeared. The source of the money is not allocated or designated. The sum was a large amount of millions, and they mentioned specifically Margaret Thatcher, and then right after that, her top aide was murdered, and then she became the prime minister. Maybe he was the middleman or the recipient for the money, and that's why he had to be murdered. This happens very often. And of course, she's ready now to recognize Rhodesia and South Africa and the races who put her into office. In Canada, Prime Minister Trudeau is out. He's been replaced by Joe Clark. There isn't much known about him except the fact that he is conservative. And of course, Margaret Trudeau, the prime minister's wife, didn't do him any favors. She waited until election time to come out with books about her drug experiences and their sex life and being photographed in bed with other men making movies and running around Club 54, mafia and drug-controlled nightclub in New York, and living it up and trying to embarrass the prime minister at a time when I imagine a little peace and family tranquility might have helped the image. We are an image-oriented society. So she did everything to sabotage Prime Minister Trudeau. And then in Germany, Karl Karstens, an ex-Nazi, ran in the Christian Democratic Party, the new president of Germany. But both candidates in this case were ex-Nazis. He says he was forced to join the Nazi Party. But an ex-Nazi is like an ex-CIA man, and let's see what he does about the statutes of limitations running off in December 79, or will he be meeting with his old Nazi cohorts when they come out from the woodwork? If you have letters to write now, write them to Karl Karstens, at the Christian Democratic Party if you want the statute not to run out, and the fact that old Nazis could still be prosecuted for war crimes. In the United States, Bert Lance and Jimmy Carter's campaign combine is being broken into. Jack Anderson is helping it by making constant references to money from Robert Vesco. And Jimmy Carter's ship is sinking, and he's being discredited given the deep six politically through the banking scandals in Georgia. Not that he doesn't deserve them if they were corrupt, but there are other corrupt people that do not get investigated, and they never go into such things as Dorothy Hunt plane crash or Martha Mitchell's kidnapping and injection or the death of Congressman William Mills or J. Edgar Hoover. And many, many deaths that are outright murders are left unturned. But sabotaging Jimmy Carter through the banking is a good way to lower his image, and of course it will help the same conservatives who won in Canada, Great Britain, and Germany. Now, one brief mention about a subject that I've talked about in regards to the Howard Hughes affair. There's an aide for Howard Hughes named Johnny Meyer. He had two Meyers, M-E-I-R is the one I'm referring to now. The other John Meyer that worked for Howard Hughes, M-E-Y-E-R, went on to work for Aristotle Onassis and Jackie Onassis, public relations Meyer. This John Meyer set up the computer department for the Hughes organization, was active in their political activities, knew much about the Hughes organization for 10 years, and he left to go to Canada. He's been charged by the Summa Corporation, the Hughes organization, for selling fraudulent land and mineral claims in Nevada and in the Southwest that were worth millions of dollars. And the IRS has been on his tail for a long time, and he has taken refuge up in Vancouver, British Columbia. On a tape, it's tape number 314, March 26, 1978, I did a tape about Howard Hughes and Johnny Myers and about his conflict with the Hughes organization. And I talked about some papers that were found in the hotel room where a man, they call him Howard Hughes, I believe it was Vance Cooper, died. And there were a large number of papers found in the room that weren't burnt or destroyed, about 1,400 pages. And these pages were copied by the Canadian government. They had a set that they gave Johnny Meyer, and Doug Wallace, an attorney from Washington, Bellingham, Washington, I believe, went up to Vancouver to get these papers from Johnny Meyer, who wanted me to have them and to analyze them. They were in the possessions of the employees of Howard Hughes at the time he died or at the time the double died. So Doug Wallace brought me these papers, and I did a tape on it. He was on the tape show with me at KLRB at the time. I was still on the air there. And December the 4th, 1977, we did a tape number 398. And March the 5th, 1978, I did some more interview with Doug Wallace on those particular tapes, 398, 311, and 314. Well, Johnny Meyer's been brought from Vancouver to Utah and being charged with forging. And the charge is brought that the documents that he had from the Howard Hughes Hotel in Mexico City did not include a section that referred to a Judge Anderson. There were six papers or so among the 1,800 pages that referred to Judge Anderson in Utah, who was to be in charge of the accusations that Johnny Meyer had swindled the Hughes people for mining swindles, taking money for land that had no minerals, and Judge Anderson was to be the judge. And Myers came up with these papers that Judge Anderson was in the pocket of the Mormon church, that they had paid him off. And then Myers claimed he couldn't get a fair trial in Utah because, according to these documents, Judge Anderson was in the control of the Mormon church. Doug Wallace took that information and wrote to the FBI and the Justice Department and wanted the judge disbarred. And now it seems that the documents on Judge Anderson were forged documents. He's being charged for forgery. And as I say, I mentioned them on tape number 314, March 26, 1978. And this is, I think, important for me to bring to your attention for those of you who have all the back tapes or who may be ordering in the back. I've done 15 years of research. I've written many articles. I've done many radio programs and many tape cassettes, but this is the first time, to my knowledge, that any information that was given to me specifically that I passed along to any listeners seems to be not correct. I may be wrong on other information, but I haven't been corrected yet. If my research was wrong in the past or up to the present day, and it's possible it was, but as of yet, I do not know of any incidents where I have been wrong or had to backtrack. I get a lot of information. I was the first person in the United States to get the gemstone file from Bruce Roberts. I was one of the first in 1970 to receive the Torbett document, that unpublished manuscript from the Southwest. I get information every week. I got some from a prisoner this week who was in Vacaville with Donald DeFries. Letters and manuscripts come to me, and I'm pretty careful to filter out what I think is provable is true and what isn't. And to the best of my knowledge, I've done a pretty good filtering process considering how much has come to me. But these six pages that were included with the 1,800 other pages were forged. At least Johnny Meyer is saying they're forged, and he's being charged with forgery. And he's the defendant, and they claim that he forged these and threw them in with the others to smear Judge Anderson. Right now, Johnny Meyer is in jail in Utah. If you don't take the Deseret News or the Salt Lake Tribune, you don't know any of this that's going on. He's held with a no bail. Doug Wallace has taken the powder. He can't be located. He's the one who brought the forged documents down to me, and Judge Anderson is pushing the case. So as far as tape 314, March 26, 1978, I did a story on Judge Anderson, the memos about him in the Howard Hughes suite penthouse in Mexico that were given to the Canadian government. And it seems that in addition to the original papers, those were forged. I'm sorry about that. It may be that at the trial, Johnny Meyer can prove that they weren't forged and that he's innocent. And then I wouldn't have to backtrack what I'm saying. But right now, there's a prosecution case, and they feel that these were planted by him in order to get Judge Anderson off the case. Now to the San Francisco scene. It's still too recent for me to be coolly objective to what is going on up there. I'm very angry. If I didn't have an appointment this week, I would have been up in San Francisco on the streets, I believe, demonstrating, and I came as close to throwing things as I ever felt, but I still have my emotions intact, and I'm fighting with the pen and the microphone for whatever it's worth. But in that very fine book that I quote over and over again called Inspection for Disarmament, edited by Seymour Melman, he tells about arming Germany for World War II, and we are really arming the United States for World War III. And he refers E.J. Gumbel in this book to the role of the law courts in Germany as they were getting ready for the war and the takeover of the Third Reich of the German government. He said the role of the law courts is important, and as I say, I've quoted this many, many times, and it applies to the San Francisco courts and Dan White. It says the political assassinations committed by members of the secret armies put a heavy burden on the administration of justice. Murderers had to be acquitted. The victims had to be shown as guilty. This task was fulfilled by the employment of military courts that sided with military men when they were accused of murder, by the slowness of the justice enforcing agencies and their inability to find the guilty or to locate them. And they would accept at face value information or claims about the accused murderer, and the very victim that they hit became responsible for his own death. There was a perversion of the courts and illegal activities that took place in the courts from the Supreme Court on down. And this book tells how, in order to get away with at least 400 political murders before Adolf Hitler came to power, one of the things they had to do was to pervert the law courts, the Supreme Court, the police, and the army, where the guilty got off, the innocent were locked up, and the victims became responsible for their own deaths. From the moment that Supervisor Harvey Milk and Mayor George Moscone were murdered, the purpose was to protect the former policeman, fireman, the program killer, and everybody in San Francisco and law enforcement played a role in that. Dianne Feinstein, a member of the Board of Supervisors, now mayor of San Francisco, got on national television and said that poor Dan White was such a good man, but he had just had a new baby, his wife had a new baby, and he opened a potato stand at Pier 39, a new fancy shopping development in San Francisco, and he had a lot of money problems because his wife was taking care of the baby and not working, and that drove him to do this cold-blooded murder. As I mentioned last week on the tape 2 weeks ago, the entire defense of Dan White was going to be that he was too good for San Francisco, that San Francisco was corrupt, that he was filled with social responsibility, he had strong ideals, the city was immoral, he wouldn't step on your toe, he couldn't hit a fly, he was too weak, he lived by the golden rule, he had a code of honor, and that was the way the trial was going 2 weeks ago, and that's the way the jury went for it. In addition to that, the way the jury was selected was completely off base. We say in a jury trial a person should have a jury of his peers, but that doesn't mean that a white policeman has a jury of military people and former policemen or people associated with the police department. The prosecution, and we'll go into that, allowed this jury without any questioning. The jury was chosen in minutes. One of the jurors, his name is Richard Aparicio. He was a former San Francisco police officer, so you would know where his interests are. He said in the press afterwards, the jurors did a tremendous job. We took into account expert testimony. They took testimony about four psychiatrists and one psychologist who became the experts, who never saw Dan White until 2 months after the murders took place. They used no experts from the Army when White was in the Army, no experts from when he was in the police department or psychologists or psychiatrists, but they chose hand-select a barrage of experts with 2- and 3-hour visits that became the experts on Dan White's state of mind. Well, he didn't even testify at all. Another juror was Mrs. Barbara Costoris, whose husband is a chef at San Francisco jail at City Hall, and she said there was no question about policemen not liking homosexuality. There was no political implications. You know, she thought the jury was fine and they did a good job. One was a former police officer. The other was married to a man who still works at the City Hall jail. Another juror was Nelson Bermudez, who does work for the Bank of America. He's a printer for Bank of America. When they say printer for Bank of America, I'm not sure who they mean. I just got some blank checks from Bank of America. They're printed by Linton Industries, which is a conduit of the CIA to overthrow Greece. So does Linton hire Bermudez? They don't say, but he works for the Bank of America and said that as they understood it, Dan White couldn't show malice towards the mayor and the supervisor, because this is in quotes from the newspaper, malice, according to the instructions, shows breaking the law in spite of an awareness that the act is illegal, doing it for a base and antisocial purpose, and with a wanton disregard for life. Now, Dan White went to a drawer in his home and filled his pocket with bullets, which are dum-dum bullets, which is a disregard for law, breaking the law because they are illegal and they're flat-edged and they cause death, these dum-dum bullets. He climbed through a window in the City Hall when people went through the desk where there were screening devices, which is not illegal to go through the window, but the purpose was to avoid detection of a weapon, and a weapon was what he was carrying. He went to the mayor's office and shot him in the body, and when the mayor fell down, he went right to his head with 3 or 4 dum-dum bullets and blew his head just practically off, right, assassination style, right into the head. He walked out of that office and didn't have silencers on the gun, and nobody went after him, and went down the hall and spoke to Dianne Feinstein, the supervisor, went into Harvey Milk's office, and 1.5 minutes later, he had reloaded his gun that he emptied out on the mayor and wasn't sure he'd have enough bullets, put in more dum-dum bullets, shot 4 in the head of Harvey Milk. He went up to his former aide and asked for the keys to her car and went to the doggy diner down the street on Van Ness, which was just blocks from the city hall. By then, the mayor had called the chief of police and said that Dan White had walked out of Harvey Milk's office and was dead. Chief of Police Charles Gaines told her that the mayor was also dead, that he knew that. Chief of Police Gaines, who I've said should not be chief of police in San Francisco, he is linked to all of the military counterintelligence COINTEL program in Oakland before he moved to San Francisco. Chief of Police Gaines did not call a cop to go to the doggy diner to pick up Dan White. They knew the car, the license, the model, because the woman who owned it had given him the keys, and she was standing in the building where two people had an assassination, a mafia-type hit right to the heads. She gave him the key. He went there. He telephoned his wife. No police car pulled up and took him in handcuffs in jail. There was never a photograph of Dan White as a criminal. That's where the cover-up began. He went to the phone and called his wife. He met his wife and walked hand in hand down the street as if nothing had happened. They went into the church where they got this religious Christian cover showing up in church. Then he goes to the police station and turns in his gun very heroically and gave himself up. And the men in the police department began to wear Free Dan White t-shirts under their uniforms. A telephone was put in his cell. He had 20 or 30 visitors. And that was what happened to Dan White. The cover-up began by the police department not circling the building and finding out how he got out and yelling and chasing after him. It began when they knew he was the killer and let him go to the restaurant or meet his wife, Pier 39, incidentally, from City Hall. It's quite a long distance. Midday traffic, it's a long distance for them to meet. They didn't tear into the church or outside or on the street. He was never photographed or seen as a criminal at any time with handcuffs or police around him. He had total isolation. Another member of the jury worked for Bechtel Corporation, which you go to your library and look up Bechtel if you want the biography. It's a large CIA front. Mother Jones had an article about it in their magazine. It's like ITT or Intertel or the USUMA organization. It has large computers and dossiers and instant information on people. It's building up Saudi Arabia, strong political communication systems. One of the jury members, the foreman, worked at Bechtel. Another worked at the Army Presidio and the military. And I believe one worked for the phone company. As they said in the newspaper this week, the jury wanted a white, Christian, middle-class law enforcement body. But it was up to the prosecutor to have blacks or gays or minorities of some kind, because Moscone was considered liberal in San Francisco, and Harvey Milk represented an area of minorities and poor and the homosexual community. But the prosecution allowed a hand-selected jury from the Army, from the police department, a former policeman, a woman whose husband cooked for the police department, Bechtel Associates. The prosecution helped the defense by admitting anything the defense wanted, and they had a hand-picked jury to make sure that Dan White got a manslaughter charge. Article in the paper this week, a loophole makes probation for Dan White possible. Under California Penal Code, it is technically possible that Dan White can escape incarceration altogether. Under Section 1203D, in this unusual case where justice would be best served, probation can be granted, even when there was the use of a deadly weapon upon a human being. The court has to decide on the special circumstances, but the law, use a gun, go to prison, which is now on appeal, would not apply to White's situation. In effect, the effect of the statute is to preclude probation where it might otherwise be granted if the person was armed during the commission of a crime. Robbery, kidnapping, rape, and burglary are listed crimes that would require you go to jail, prison, if you use a gun. But manslaughter is not included. Can you believe that one? Since Watergate, with white-collar crimes, people call the bleeding liberals the ones that are easing up the laws. But it's the other way around. Now that their own are going to jail, they're writing the laws easier. So you can rob, You can kidnap, rape, and burglarize. If you have a gun, you go to prison. Manslaughter, kill two people, kill one, reload, kill another. You don't have to go to prison. You can be on probation. Now, that is what Seymour Melman warned about. If you study what happened in Germany, the killers were needed, and they were used over and over again. Then they ran the Gestapo and the Secret Service there in Germany. That is what he means by perverting the courts of law. If manslaughter, you're off. Call it murder for the poor, manslaughter for the rich, and you twist the court around so that the man who killed two political people is home free. Now, November the 1st, Representative Leo Ryan was going to Guyana. As I mentioned on several other tapes, there was a contingency to kill everybody if he went down there. But that's an important date. December the 1st, 1978, Leo Ryan sent Jim Jones a telegram that he was going to visit Jonestown. He had a friend, Associated Press photographer Sammy Houston, whose son Robert Houston was murdered by Jones followers when he defected. He also had a nephew, Leo Ryan, who disappeared after he got linked up with the Scientologists. So Ryan had personal reasons for going in. On November the 1st, he had made the decision, I am going down to Jonestown. And there was this contingency that I mentioned on many tapes earlier and last week, a contingency to kill Leo Ryan if he went down to Jonestown and killed the other people. Now, November the 1st, 1978, the same day that Leo Ryan sent a message that he was going to see Jim Jones, and don't forget the offices for the People's Temple were in San Francisco, that same day, Dan White, who was on the Board of Supervisors, resigned from the Board of Supervisors. November the 1st, Ryan says, I'm going to Guyana, and November the 1st, Dan White resigns from the Board of Supervisors, which will later be the motive for murdering George Moscone. In San Francisco, George Moscone, the mayor, U.S. Attorney Hunter, D.A. Joseph Freitas, were all involved with Jonestown. It was a depot for shipping people out. Guns, drugs, and cash were sent from there. Welfare recipients were sent down, and their passports were taken away, and they were drugged and poisoned and humiliated. Juveniles were sent for experimentation. It was a cover for training assassins. They obtained signed confessions for assassinations. The entire San Francisco political structure was involved, and the day that Leo Ryan had said, I am coming down, was the day that Dan White resigned from the Board of Supervisors. And as I said before, Moscone would have to be killed. Like Leo Ryan, there was a contingency. He's similar to the people who knew too much about Watergate or in the John Kennedy assassination, people like William Harvey and Sheffield Edwards and Donald Donaldson and George DeMoranchil, Gary Powers, John Rosselli, Sam Giancana. He was important. Moscone was important, like Donaldson, DeMoranchil, William Sullivan. And if Ryan went down and if the Jonestown truth came out, Moscone had to be killed. Dan White was a program killer from his Vietnam police fire department days, and he was to be used as a killer to protect the police department's involvement in Jonestown. I believe that. I don't believe he expected to go back to be on the Board of Supervisors. I believe he was a selected patsy, and even though they described him in the court as a robot and a zombie, and the word robot was in the papers again this week, which I think is interesting because robots do not create themselves. They are created by other masters. And when Dan White walked in, turned in his tape, and made a confession statement, November 27th, 1979, after the killings, he surrendered, and this is what he said. Some of the people have charged me with taking money from big corporations and not recording it, but I never did that. They were going to use me as a scapegoat. Whether or not I was a good supervisor was not the point. This was a political opportunity, and they were going to degradate me and my family and more or less hang me out to dry. Now, that's his political statement. And the point is that the prosecution had to go slow because he knows who they were. He knows who the corporations are. He knows who bought the Porsche, the Mercedes, the home, the financing for Dan White, the trips to Ireland, the honeymoon, 5-week honeymoon to Ireland. He knows where he's been. And even though he can't possess himself to stop the killings, and he's programmed to do it, I'm sure he had the guarantee, and all he had to do was say, "This city is corrupt, you're all foul, and I will not hang out to dry," which was what he said on his tape confession. And that was played for the courts when they began their hearing, that he would be the scapegoat. And this was part of his confession, that people in San Francisco wanted to use him as part of a political opportunity. As I say, on November 27, 1978, Mayor George Moscone was killed. Supervisor Harvey Milk was killed. White walks out. He hadn't used a silencer. He wasn't stopped. Nobody yelled or grabbed him. Harvey Milk was murdered after he walked out of there. No one stopped him. No one followed him. No one went to the doggy diner or the church or on the streets. No police car went after him. How long do you think it would take to find another person who killed two public officials in a building when they walk out and get in a car and drive away and park three or four blocks away to make a telephone call? How long do you think it would take the police to find that car? Why didn't they find Dan White? On the other side of this tape, we'll do some more about this, because this is a symptom of the sickness of the mentality of the psychiatrists and the courts in San Francisco. And what goes in San Francisco will hit your towns sooner or later if it isn't there already.